old Katrina stole it. The one sitting with us does not recall that. And, on realizing what she had done, she took the necessary steps to retrieve the necklace. Dangerous steps that nearly cost Katrina her life. MacReady continues to grumble, but his anger will pass quickly. Quick to temper and quicker to laughter, as my Nan would say. It's Gray I watch. It's the weight of his anger that I feel. His is deeper. His will linger. Is there anything else we should know about, Katrina? He asks finally, that cool gaze turning on me. Isla tries to cut in, but I beat her to it.
I honestly do not know, sir.
Mrs. Ballantyne mentioned the locket, and knowing I have stolen things in the past, I feared I had taken it. I presumed if I had, it would be at the pawnbroker. Fortunately, it was. There may be other things I took before my accident. There may be things I said or did before my accident. Nothing since.
So you have been forthright with us on all subjects since the accident?
Duncan, Isla says, that is an entirely unfair question. Let me rephrase that with respect to her right to a private life. Katrina, have you stolen anything since your accident? From us or from anyone else?
Only a cup of coffee.
At her look, I say, it was from Dr. Gray's breakfast tray. He didn't finish his morning pot, and so I had a cup. Isla struggles to suppress a smile and says gravely, we shall see that you are allowed your own coffee.
Thank you.
Since your accident, have you lied about anything related to your employment or your position as a member of this household?
Not to the best of my knowledge. It is possible that I said something that was not true because I don't remember the truth, but I have not intentionally lied.
Since your accident, have you done anything that could harm any member of this household?
No.
Isla glances at her brother, as MacReady jokes about her taking a job as a barrister. His anger has already passed. Gray stays quiet. He's not going to say that he accepts my words at face value. I'm not exactly hooked up to a polygraph. But he isn't challenging me further. And that's the best I can hope for. I continue with my story. MacReady is impressed by how I fought back and teases that Isla should have a knife of her own, to which she heartily agrees, and he realizes that was a dangerous joke to make. There's a little back and forth there, with him trying to talk her out of it and her making plans to purchase one post-haste. Gray pushes to his feet.
You've put the idea into her head, Hugh, and there will be no getting it out. The best you can do is teach her how to use it.
Use a knife? He sputters.
Would you prefer a revolver?
Isla says.
Although, now that you mention it...
I did not mention it. You did.
I should like a revolver. One of those tiny ones that American ladies carry in their handbags.
They do not carry pistols in their handbags, Isla. You have been reading too many of those novels of yours.
But one would fit in a handbag, would it not?
That is an excellent idea, Hugh. Thank you for suggesting it.
I did not suggest it.
Gray clears his throat. Please do continue this lively discussion without me. I have a body to attend to. He rises and gets to the door before looking at me. When his brows knit, I almost exhale in relief. Okay, so he might not have forgiven me for the locket yet, but he isn't angry enough to bar me from the examination room. I nod and hurry after him. Chapter 29. Addington is gone. And Gray is furious about that. The dark cloud of anger hovering over locket-stealing Katrina shifts over a new target.
Addington was supposed to come upstairs and speak to MacReady before he left. That's apparently the real reason MacReady was having lunch here. He was waiting for Addington's report. Addington and his assistant finished the autopsy and left notes jotted in a nearly indecipherable scrawl.
"He will file a report, won't he?"
I ask, as Gray glowers at the brief notes.
"Report," he says without looking up.
I search for a word. Coroner isn't used here. Pathologist is too much for Katrina.
The report that police surgeons make after an autopsy.
There is one, is there not?
Please tell me there is one.
"He will sign the death certificate stating cause of death," Gray says. "Otherwise, he will make notes to present at court. Detective MacReady will receive an oral report, but he's going to need to chase Addington down to get it. That is inexcusable."
"Is it possible?"
I clear my throat. I know you are not licensed to practice medicine." His shoulders tense. I hurry on. I do not mean any insult, sir. I was only going to say..."
"Surgery," he says. "Not medicine. I studied jointly in medicine and surgery, but intended to pursue the latter."
"All right. Surgery, then. Still, the fact that you have the degrees means you're at least as qualified as Addington, licensed or not. I understand the lawyers need the police surgeon on the witness stand, but would it be possible for you to perform autopsies? With him in attendance?"
Gray snorts and slaps the paper onto his desk as he strides from the office.
"Addington would never agree to it."
A hesitation, and then he glances back, his chin dipping.
"It is an excellent idea, Katrina. I am not dismissing that. Detective MacReady and I have discussed it, as we have discussed the possibility of both being present at the autopsy, which is quite routine. Criminal autopsies are sometimes even performed in surgical theaters."
"But more witnesses could mean more people to realize Addington is making mistakes."
Gray grunts and pulls open the door to the examination room.
"Addington is too well connected for Detective MacReady to argue with his process. We must simply be thankful that we may confirm his work after the fact. Now, let us do that."
It doesn't take me long to realize the true root of Gray's anger. Yes, he's annoyed that Addington left without speaking to MacReady, but what truly infuriated him was that preliminary report. On it, Addington listed the cut throat as the cause of death. It is not. As we guessed earlier, and Gray confirms now, Rose Wright died of strangulation. The killer strangled her, moved her body in front of that gate, and then slashed her throat and stabbed her in the stomach. That could be pure convenience. A bloodless killing with the mutilations added on the staged scene. I can't tell them about the staging, though. Can't say that the killer moved the body there because it resembles the spot where a woman will be murdered 20 years from now. Gray presumes the killer strangled her in a more private location, and then displayed her in a busier one. And I need to go along with that.
"May I speculate, sir?"
I ask, as he measures the abdominal wounds.
"Certainly. That is the process of learning, Katrina. Ask questions and hazard guesses."
"I think he strangled her because that's how he likes to kill. Come up behind a victim and strangle them with rope. It means they don't see him, but it also means he doesn't see them, doesn't watch their face as they die."
Gray pauses to look at me.
"Interesting. You believe he is affected by their deaths?"
I don't think so. I would imagine that only applies in cases where you regret needing to kill someone. He's choosing to kill. It isn't about caring, it's about not caring. He isn't doing it because he enjoys the act of killing.
He enjoys hunting his victims and the victory of success and any notoriety that comes with it. But he doesn't care about the act of killing. He does it quickly and efficiently. I pause, but Gray says,
"Go on."
Archie Evans was a bloodless death. Literally and figuratively, as you said. No one cared. To make them care, he gave them what he thinks they want.
I wave at Rose's body.
This.
His head tilts.
You believe he craves attention, then?
The elaborate staging of Archie Evans would indicate as much, would it not?
It does. It was a theory of my own, which is why I wanted those newspapers the other day.
He looks at Rose.
He failed to attain the desired degree of notoriety, and so he progressed to this.
Escalation.
His lips purse.
Yes. Escalation. An excellent word. You seem to have a knack for this, Katrina.
If you are implying that I understand the killer's mind too intimately, I was asleep when Rose was murdered. Also, I'm not strong enough to strangle someone Archie Evans' size.
Ah, but you did fight off a killer. I believe you underestimate your strength. No, I don't suspect you of these murders. The killer must have been sizable enough to carry her to the scene, as a cart would have attracted notice. Therefore, it could not have been you, unless you have developed superhuman strength as a side effect of your memory loss.
He peers at me.
Have you?
I smile.
Sadly, no. Though I do seem quite capable of lugging around buckets of soapy water.
I glance at him.
How far could you carry a woman of her size?
His startled look makes me laugh.
I was not insinuating that you might be responsible, sir. I mean that you are larger than the man who attacked me in the alley, and you seem quite physically fit. I believe Detective MacReady mentioned something about a propensity for brawling?
Lies, lies, and damnable lies. I take your meaning, though. How far could I carry this woman? It is an excellent question.
He looks down at her.
One that is best answered through experimentation. Sadly, she is in no condition to be slung over my shoulder.
Yeah, I'm not running along behind, collecting her entrails.
That gets a full, sputtered laugh from him.
Such a lack of appreciation for science.
You are nearly as bad as your predecessor, young James.
He eyes her.
How much do you think she weighs?
130,
I say.
When his brows shoot up, I say, 9 stone?
I am not surprised at the unit of measurement, but at the speed of your assessment. You are quite good at that.
I used to work in a carnival guessing weights.
His eyes spark with interest.
Did you?
That was a joke, sir. Is there such an occupation?
Of course. It is extremely popular, primarily as a way of discovering one's weight if one does not possess a scale.
I'm not sure whether he's joking, so I make a non-committal noise.
How much do you weigh?
He asks.
I raise my brows in mock horror.
A gentleman never asks a lady such a thing.
His look of confusion tells me that's not the invasive question it will be in 150 years.
I need a scale to be sure, I say. Probably about the same?
I catch his look and lift my hands.
Oh, no, if you're suggesting...
I must conduct the experiment in some fashion, and you are my assistant.
No.
But science...
His eyes sparkle with mischief, and my heart does a little flip.
Oh, no. There will be none of that, Mallory. That way lies madness.
Also, serious disappointment. Because when he looks at me, he sees his teenage apprentice. Nothing more.
Fine, I say with a sigh. After you were done checking Dr. Addington's work, you may test how far you could reasonably carry my dead weight. Preferably when I'm not actually dead.
But science!
I shake my head, and we get back to work. There is no doubt Rose was killed by strangulation. Gray confirms all the signs that allow him to make that determination. Strangled first, and then methodically stabbed to match the marks left on Polly Nichols, which means I'm not the only one who studied the Ripper's crimes. I am going to speculate further that the killer didn't leap straight into Ripper-style killings because he considers Jack a hack. A butcher, chopping up victims for maximum carnage and shock value. Oh, I know the theories about the Ripper being a doctor. But with Gray, I can see a live 19th century surgeon at work, and I can question him under the guise of the current crime. That's a little harder when this victim, unlike the Ripper's later ones, hasn't had any organs removed. But Gray isn't the kind of guy who suspects the motivations of anyone seeking knowledge. He says that a surgeon would certainly know where to find organs. A doctor should, but the amount of anatomical and surgical experience a regular physician has depends on where and when he was trained. A butcher would have more, at least in the sense of being able to infer anatomical placement from the similarities between humans and pigs. By no means, then, did the Ripper need to be a surgeon to remove organs from human bodies. And there's no surgical skill displayed with Rose's death. Two slashes to her throat, one twice the length of the other. One long, savage slice to the abdomen, and several smaller stabs, plus two to the groin. It's butchery so basic that I suspect an actual butcher would take offense at the comparison. I think this killer originally wanted to do better than Jack the Ripper. He wanted to be fancy, be symbolic. And he failed miserably because, quite frankly, no one gave a damn. At least, not the degree of giving a damn that would put him into the history books. This could, if he keeps it up. Our job is to make sure he doesn't. When will he strike again? I should know, right? I studied the crimes. Yet it's like not knowing exactly when forensic breakthroughs occurred. My interest was in facts, not dates. I do know the Ripper's entire killing spree lasted only a month, which means he could take his next victim any time now. This killer will follow the pattern, and he does know it. I'm sure of that. I make notes as Gray rattles off observations. Right-handed killer, judging by the angle of the cuts. Hesitation cuts, as I noted, which supports my personal view that the guy's heart wasn't in his work. The stab wounds suggest a thin-bladed knife. There's no indication that a separate knife was used for the throat. He does, however, find a rope fiber in the neck wound, which he will use under Isla's microscope to compare to any rope discovered in the investigation. Gray also examines the clothing for fibers and hairs, explaining, as he does, that MacReady is not convinced of the usefulness of this, but Gray has read a French paper postulating potential analysis of fibers, hair, and other particles left at crime scenes. There are no hairs, not even the victims, which suggests the killer removed them. When I say as much to Gray, he agrees that's an excellent idea. But I can tell he doesn't see why the killer would remove hairs when they can't yet be analyzed as evidence. That's all Gray can get from the body. Then comes the part where he sees how far he can carry me. He tries a few holds before I suggest the firefighter carry, without using that modern term, of course. He agrees that is the most efficient method. With me slung over his shoulder, Gray walks around the funeral parlor, counting off an impressive 200 paces before he begins to tire. Then, after catching his breath, he wants to test out stairs. We're on the second story when Isla throws open the stairwell door. I jump, flailing. Gray only tightens his grip while shooing his sister away with a jerk of his chin. "You are blocking our path," he says. She leans around him to look at me. Do I even want to ask what you're doing?
Science, I say.
I see. And more specifically? The killer removed Rose's body after he strangled her, I say, before he inflicted the other wounds. She's roughly my weight, and the killer I saw is smaller than Dr. Gray, so this will provide some idea of how far he could have carried her.
Up a flight of stairs.
I am accounting for the elevation progression within the city, Gray says. Also, whether it would have proved overly difficult to carry her downstairs. First, I must get her up them.
Aha. Well, do not let Mrs. Wallace see you carrying Katrina over your shoulder. I shudder to imagine what she'd think.
I shall explain.
No, please, don't. Finish your experiment and join me in the library for tea.
Is that an order? Gray says.
It is. I invited Hugh to join us, so we may hear his update and share yours.
We are very busy, Isla. I am not certain we have time for tea.
I picked up cream pastries this morning. Also coffee for Katrina, so she may no longer need to sip piteously at your dregs.
He hadn't touched the coffee I drank, I say.
Which isn't to say his dregs aren't tempting.
Are they now?
Her eyes glitter, and I'm glad I'm slung over Gray's shoulder, so I can make a face at her and roll my eyes. She laughs and pats my shoulder. Coffee and tea, cream pastries and lemon cake. 5 o'clock in the library. Do not be late.
Chapter 30. When we talk to MacReady, I'm glad I made the choice to stay with Gray. MacReady's interview brought him nothing, even with the additional questions we brainstormed.
I know Duncan has theorized that Evans was tortured, MacReady says as he sips his tea, which implies a connection between the two men. But if there is such a connection with Rose Wright, I have no idea what it might be. Her sister is a respectable lady, a laundress. Rose helped when she... well... when she was able. She liked her drink and was often in no shape to assist her sister in the mornings, if you take my meaning.
He means Rose was an alcoholic, whose heavy drinking meant she could rarely rouse herself from bed before noon. It's tempting to look at someone like Rose and compare her with her industrious and respectable sister. But it's rarely that easy, and I give MacReady full credit for digging deeper. Rose was 10 years older than her sister. She'd been married, happily enough, it seems, and worked in a factory. 5 children. The only two who survived infancy both died in the cholera epidemic of 1856, along with her husband. The doctor prescribed laudanum to help with her nerves. Shockingly, the death of her entire family within a week had sent her into a depression. From laudanum, Rose moved to alcohol, eventually losing her job and her home, and then going to live with her younger sister, where she helped with the laundry and the children. She went out in the evenings a few times each week, sweeping floors for local shops and then having a drink with friends. Rose didn't really clean shops in the evening. MacReady confirmed that easily enough. She was doing sex work. She'd earn enough for the night's drinking and bring home a shilling or two, always apologizing that it wasn't more. I can imagine her planning for it to be more, to bring all those coins to her sister after just one drink. One drink to take the edge off, banish the ghosts and boost her self-esteem. One turned into 2, which turned into 5, and it is a testament to her willpower, or her love for her sister, that she came home with any money at all. A sad life, with a tragic end. Was there a connection to the killer? My gut says that he needs that. But in this case, he also needed a woman who'd match Polly Nichols close enough to mimic the Ripper. Maybe that was enough. If there was more, it might have only been a passing encounter, like the one we had in the coffee shop. I'm digging too deep. I know that. Fixating on a connection with the victim. Fixating on the Jack the Ripper connection. Those are distractions. I need to strip them away and focus on the true connection, the one that matters. Our killer inhabits the body of whoever tried to strangle Katrina a week ago. Forget who's inside that body. Forget his motives. Find Katrina's would-be killer, and I can stop him before another Rose dies. Our killer is my attempted killer, in the body of Katrina's attempted killer. Who would want to murder Katrina? I think who wouldn't might be the easier question to answer. She stole from those who tried to help her, like Isla and Gray, fought with those who trusted her, like Simon, betrayed those who wooed her, like Findlay. Bullied Alice, gave Mrs. Wallace endless grief, double-crossed her allies like Davina. And those are just the people in her life that I know. Are any of those betrayals motives for murder? As a cop, I learned that's a far less useful question than one might think. I've known people who killed a partner to escape horrible abuse, and some still insisted that wasn't a valid motive for murder. I've also known a guy who killed his neighbor for having loud dinner parties, and a woman who tried to kill a job rival. In neither case would I remotely see motive for murder, but they still tried to convince a jury of it. I need to learn more about Katrina. Talk to Davina. Talk to Isla, too. Get Katrina's background from Isla and find out from Davina what Katrina had been up to recently. Even if that takes every coin in my stash. Still, I feel as if I'm about to wade into shark-infested waters trying to find the one shark who did this. I stare at the ceiling, mentally sorting through data and feeling pulled in 20 directions while working with both hands tied behind my back. I saw Katrina being strangled, but as hard as I rack my brain, I can recall nothing of her killer except the sense that it was a man. Otherwise, the links only further complicate the crime, and I need to constantly pull apart those threads before they hopelessly tangle. As for the tied hands part, well, I'm not a detective here, not a criminal officer, not a constable. Hell, I'm not even a man. And for all the times I felt hampered by that in the modern world, it is the difference between having to swim upstream and being kept out of the river altogether. I have a crime to investigate. I am the person best qualified to solve it, because the killer comes from my world, which I cannot tell the investigating officer. Yet my days are not my own. I'll get up tomorrow and take Gray his coffee, and if I'm lucky, he'll keep me up to date on MacReady's investigation. And maybe I can add my 2 cents, but that's it. I want to tell Isla I need a few days off, so I can go out and investigate. Go out where? Investigate how? I'd need MacReady for that, and there's no logical way for me to insert myself into the active part of his investigation. I'll talk to Isla, convince her to help me get more access. Can I tell her about the link between this killer and my 21st century one? I'm not sure yet. I need to work it through more and tread carefully. The tangled threads make my head spin as they cinch ever tighter. I need paper and a pen so I can get my thoughts out of my head. When the clock strikes midnight, I'm reasonably certain everyone will be in bed. And so I sneak down the back stairs to the second floor and head for the library. I'm creeping across the cold floors when a board creaks and I freeze. What if someone catches me in the library at this hour? I can't keep asking Isla to get me out of scrapes. I tell myself I'm overreacting. If I'm caught, I'll take a book. I'm allowed to borrow them, and it's understandable that I might get one if I can't sleep. I cock my head, listening. but the house has gone still. I continue on to the library. I consider lighting a lamp, but instead just open the drapery enough to catch moonlight. Find a book first. That will make my cover story more plausible. The problem here is that the minute I begin perusing the bookcases, I lose myself in possibilities, all whispering to be pulled from the shelves. Victorian fiction that I doubt my father has heard of. Contemporary works, lost to time. Scientific and historical texts of every variety, each promising a glimpse into past theories and thoughts, their gorgeous vellum pages nestled between leather covers. I ignore all those temptations and head straight to the shelf of texts that might be of interest to a budding forensic scientist. I pull out a translated French book, A General System of Toxicology, or A Treatise on Poisons, by Matthew Orfila. I resist the urge to open it and instead lay it on the desk, ready to grab if I hear anyone. I'm easing out the desk chair when a whisper comes, like an opening door, and I'm on my feet, book clutched in my hands. Silence falls again, but as I stand there holding the book, some sliver of awareness tickles down my spine. The same one I'd felt earlier today, standing near Rose's body and wondering whether the killer could be in the crowd. With the book under one arm, I slip to the door. I glance down at the leather-bound tome and weigh its use as a potential weapon against the chance this is just a member of the household. I don't want to be found sneaking around holding a fire poker. Nor do I want to come up against the killer while armed only with a book on forensic toxicology. Damn it, I should have brought my knife. I back up to the fire and grab the poker. Book in one hand, weapon in the other. That will make sense if I explain that I'd been getting something to read when I heard a noise. I slide into the hall. As I creep down it, I check each room. But the drawn drapes make it impossible to see more than the shapes of furnishings. I reach the hall and consider, and then head for the stairs. As I set my foot on the first one, a creak sounds, one that doesn't come from under my feet. I peer down into darkness below. Nothing. I wait another moment, ears straining. When it stays quiet, I remind myself that this is an old house, prone to creaks and groans. No, Mallory. This townhouse might be a historic building in your time, but it's 50 or 60 years old in this world. With the solid construction, it's no more given to creaking than my condo at home. Still, any house can be subject to noises. And that must be what I've heard, because it's gone quiet and it's staying quiet. I continue down the stairs, poker in hand, hearing nothing more than a creak or two of the floorboards under my own feet. At the bottom, I pause to look both ways, and then I stride to the front door. I check it. Locked. Walk to the back door. Also locked. Good. If there's anyone about, it's only one of my housemates, getting a glass of water or using the water closet. I return to the library, and I'm pulling open a desk drawer when I am certain I hear a clack from somewhere in the house. I freeze. Then I rise with my book in hand. Halfway to the door, I realize I left the drawer open. I hesitate, but force myself into the hall, where I listen. Listen, and hear nothing. Okay, now I'm being paranoid. The doors are locked. There's no one here. With these high ceilings, I probably heard the echo of the damn drawer opening. One last peer down the dark hallway, and I retreat to the desk. I reach into the drawer where I know Isla keeps paper. Next comes the pen, plucked from a holder on the desktop. It's a gorgeous engraved silver combination dip pen and mechanical pencil that I can imagine my father salivating over. That's the second time I've thought of him in the last hour. And each nudge brings an affectionate smile, followed by a surge of panic. My dad would love this pen. When I get home, I should find one in an antiques shop for him. What if I don't get home? What if Katrina is in my body? What if I never see my parents again? Deep breaths to calm my racing heart. What's the saying about long, dark nights of the soul? The witching hour for all my worst fears to toil and boil forth, from a killer in the house to never seeing my parents again. I cannot control the last part, except in the sense that solving Katrina's murder might be the key to unlocking the gate. Maybe I was brought through time to stop her killer before he struck again. Except it's no longer the same guy, and I'm doing a really shitty job of stopping him. I press my fingers to my temples, return to the desk, and sit again. I lift my pen over the blank page to be frozen exactly as I was upstairs. Where to begin? What's the starting thread? The current murders? Katrina's initial attack? Or her second attack, the one I'd faced, which requires the killer knowing she's helping Gray and MacReady? Stop. It doesn't matter where I start. Just write it all down. Current murders. First victim, Archie Evans, chosen because the killer wanted information from him. He knew something. Wait. Wait right there. We'd been checking out Evans's housemates, trying to determine what the killer wanted from him. What he'd been tortured for. It had seemed connected to his housemates' anti-immigrant efforts. Except that wouldn't interest a modern-day killer. Whatever his own beliefs, he's not going after Evans to extract information on a 19th-century anti-immigration movement. What did he want? He killed Evans within 2 days of arriving in this world. He'd barely arrived. What would he want? What could he want? I let my mind drift back to my first day here, waking in the bed upstairs, waking in a world and a body I didn't recognize. What did I want? Answers. Who am I? Where am I? I'd gotten them by asking Gray, under the guise of mental confusion. The killer isn't going to grab a random guy on the street and torture him for information that he could get by feigning a blow to the head until someone took pity and answered. Where am I? What year is it? What day is it? Hell, he could get those answers by finding a newspaper stand. What couldn't he find as easily? Who am I? The man whose body the killer inhabits knew Evans. He was connected to him in a way that meant he had the information the killer needed. Who am I? Where do I live? What do I do for a living? He wouldn't need to torture Evans for that. Fake a blow to the head and ask, and if Evans got suspicious, then he could kill him. Torture meant he needed more. What more did I need when I arrived? Everything. It was like being dropped into a foreign country where you barely speak the same language. How do I wake up in the morning? What are my duties? How do I perform those duties? Where is the mop, the water, the soap? I'd had my safe cocoon, a house full of decent people who made allowances for me. Yet I'd needed more. So much more. All the things I'm still figuring out, including information on this body I'm inhabiting. Luckily, I have Isla now, but those early days had been a constant cloud of fear that I'd be found out because I didn't know the first damn thing about Katrina, and memory problems only got me so far. The killer had two choices. Live as the person whose body he inhabited, or start over. Living as that person meant having a home and belongings and a job. But it also meant understanding that person's life in a way I'd skipped with Katrina. This is what he wanted from Evans. Not just, who am I? But the crux of that question. Tell me everything about myself so I can fully inhabit this life. Where am I from? What do I like? How do I act? Who do I know? That's why he needed torture. He'd captured Evans with the intention of getting as much as possible from him and then killing him, both to cover his tracks and to renew his pursuit of serial killer fame. This means that Katrina's would-be killer knew Evans, knew him well enough that the killer recognized him as a source of invaluable information. I need to learn more about Evans. He lived with students. Was he also a student? Part-time, maybe? Wait, MacReady said he was English. Maybe he came for school in Edinburgh. He wrote for a newspaper, the Evening Courant. Was that something done in an office, with colleagues, or freelance? I'll need to ask Isla. I'm writing feverishly when I catch the distinct sound of footsteps. I grab the poker, stride to the door, and peer into darkness. It's quiet again. God damn it. Are my nerves working overtime, or is someone actually out there? I walk into the hall. Hello? I say. Because by this point, if it's just Alice sneaking around to see what I'm doing, I'd rather deal with that than keep being interrupted. I walk along the hall and through the drawing room and dining room, seeing no one. If anyone's there, I'm reading in the library, I helpfully announce to my would-be killer. I sigh, adjust my grip on the poker, and return to the library. Back at the desk, I pause and peer around. Nothing. I set the poker on the desktop within reach, and then I'm pulling out the chair when a floorboard creaks behind me. Chapter 31. I spin just as a dark cloaked figure lunges out from behind the drapes. He claps a hand over my mouth. I elbow him in the ribs and then wheel and slam my fist into his stomach. Before he doubles over, I catch a glimpse of an average-sized man with a black mask. Then I realize the mask is dark hair falling over his face as he doubles over in pain. I grab his hair and wrench his head up. Simon?
Surrender, he croaks, raising his arms. I acknowledge defeat, fair maiden.
What the hell? I say as he rises, still holding his stomach.
Nicely done, cat, he grunts as he catches his breath. I suppose I deserved that, trying to spook you.
By leaping from behind the curtains? 2 days after I was attacked and nearly killed in the streets?
He hesitates. 2 days? It has been a week.
I was attacked again 2 days ago and spent the damn night in jail for fighting off my attacker.
I back up to the desk and fold the papers. I heard nothing of that, he says. I do apologize then, Kat, and I cannot help but be grateful I escaped with my life. He rubs his stomach and makes a face. Whoever taught you to fight like that? The experience of nearly being killed twice in less than a week? No doubt, and again, I do apologize.
He glances behind me.
What are you writing?
Nothing. He tries to snatch the pages, and we do a couple rounds of that before he sees I'm serious and stops. He perches on the edge of the desk as I secret the pages away in my bodice.
What are you doing in here? I say. It is the house where I am employed?
I mean, you're inside at night. How'd you get in?
With my key? Because it is the house where I am employed. I came in search of food. I was up late and grew hungry.
The kitchen is 2 floors down.
Yes, but I heard someone moving about as I was in the stairwell.
I came to see who it was and warn that I was in the house so that I did not startle them.
Instead, you intentionally startled me.
Because you are special. He grins.
You ought to have seen your face.
Now, if you are quite finished with the interrogation, I have a proposition.
Uh-huh.
He leans over and whispers.
I have a penny stick in my rooms.
Is that the Victorian equivalent of inviting me to his room to see his etchings?
I don't think I need to see your stick, I say. Not tonight.
See my stick? He sputters. How hard was that knock on your head? I mean, I have a penny stick of opium.
I blink before I manage to say, No, thank you. I'm having quite enough trouble keeping my mind clear these days. That hit on the head is affecting me more than I expected.
I look over at him.
I know you said you had no idea who might have attacked me, but would you mind if I asked you a few questions? About myself? Filling in the holes?
Would I mind? You sound as if you were asking a favor of a stranger, Kat. We are friends, are we not?
We are, but it is awkward, admitting to memory lapses. It makes me feel quite freakish.
He sobers, his voice lowering. We ought never to feel that way between ourselves. The world gives us enough of that. You may ask what you will, and I will answer as much as I am able and not judge you for your questions.
He meets my gaze.
No judgment. Not between us. Yes?
Yes. Thank you.
We head down to the kitchen, where we find day-old bread and butter, and Simon makes a pot of tea. Then I question him. I start by asking him about my past. He can't help there. Katrina didn't share any of that. Nor does he know anything about her criminal confederates. In that case, he didn't want to know details. I'll need to speak to Davina. If Katrina knew her attacker, that puts one degree of separation between her and Evans. Possibly no degrees, if all three shared a connection. Evans's roommate suggested he sold information on their group. To whom? A link shimmers there. Between Evans selling his group's secrets and Katrina selling Findlay's police information. Could they have been selling to the same person? Or connected in the same underground web? Evans is friends with someone in that world, whom he uses to sell his information, and Katrina has pissed off, or betrayed, that same person, who tried to kill her for it. Is that my link?
Do you know a young man named Archie Evans? I ask.
Simon stops mid-bite to look at me. Yes. The fellow that Raven killer murdered. You helped Dr. Gray with the body, did you not? Alice said so. He peers at me.
Are your new memories affected as well? I meant, did you know him before he was murdered?
His eyes narrow.
What are you implying, Kat? I am wondering whether I had a connection to him. He seemed familiar.
Simon relaxes and shrugs. He wrote for the Evening Courant. I've read the paper to you many a time, and I may have mentioned him as the writer.
Did I ever mention him?
Not that I recall.
He lived with a group of radicalized students. Anti-immigration, anyone who does not look and act like them.
Are you suggesting you might have hobnobbed with the likes of them?
I hope not, but I don't remember.
He shakes his head firmly. You have many faults, Kat, but if bigotry were one of them, we could hardly be friends. It is not. Well, score one for Katrina. But I also must wonder how well Simon really knew Katrina. He seems like a sweet kid, and when he mentioned Alice, he seemed fond of her. Did he know Katrina abused her? I doubt it, which makes me wonder whether Evans's group really could be the key, and Katrina just knew enough to keep her bigotry from Simon. She was, after all, a master at showing people what they wanted to see. With that, I hit a brick wall. Simon has nothing for me, and I chat a little longer, not wanting him to feel interrogated and dismissed, before I yawn and declare it past time for bed. I see the glimmer of a lead in the cord connecting Archie Evans to his killer, and possibly to Katrina. That realization has me up just before the clock downstairs strikes 5. I leap from bed with the morning light, dress, tear into the hall, and promptly collide with poor Alice coming to wake me. A quick apology, and then I'm racing down the stairs to begin my day by taking Gray his breakfast tray. He's already up, according to Mrs. Wallace, and I skip my morning bread and tea to take his tray to his room. "Wouldn't want the master's coffee getting cold," I say, when Mrs. Wallace grumbles at me for yanking it from her hands. I take the stairs as fast as I can without toppling the coffee pot. At Gray's door, I pause and inhale. Then I tap and await the invitation before entering. Gray is hard at work, and seeing that, I have to smile. It's not just the hard at work before 6 a.m. part, which is normal for him. It's the fact that he appears to have done little more than roll from his bed to his desk chair, with the coverlet still draped around his shoulders. "Might I hope you are in an appropriate state of dress under that, sir?" I ask. He only grunts, which means it could go either way. I set down the tray and start the fire. I'm so much better at this now, my inner girl guide beaming with pride. It helps to make sure the fire is prepped before he retires to bed. It also helps if he doesn't decide to light it at night and work into the wee hours. I have it going quickly, and by then he's let the coverlet fall to show, yes, he's decent, with his shirt mostly buttoned. He shrugged off the coverlet without stopping his writing, and I pick it up and begin folding. He gives a grunt that seems to mean he'll do that, but I keep going, neatly folding it and then picking up his socks and laying them out for him. That morning, I am maid of the month material. For the same reason, I came racing up with his breakfast. When I decide I've been solicitous enough to lower his defenses, I say, "Might we discuss the case, sir?" He keeps writing, and my mood drops a notch. I'm about to try again, maybe ask if there's a time we can discuss it, when he taps his pen into the holder and swivels in his chair.
"You have thoughts?" he says.
I perk up. "I do, sir. I would like to return to the first victim, Archie Evans."
He frowns. "Evans?"
"We have not yet ascertained the purpose of the torture. What information was the killer trying to extract? It suggests Evans knew his killer."
The frown deepens. "It does?"
"Yes." Here I stumble, because I can't tell Gray what I think the killer wanted and how that proves a personal connection. "I believe we should consider the very strong possibility that they knew one another." His gaze slips back to his notebook, and I feel the ground under my feet eroding.
"I suppose that is a possibility," he says slowly. "Why don't you think more on it, Katrina, and present your theory to Detective MacCready at tea this afternoon?"
"This afternoon?"
"Yes."
Gray is already turning back to his work.
"As much as I would like to pursue the case sooner, I have a paper due, and I have fallen behind. I hope to have time for an investigative update at tea. Tell my sister, please, in case she would care to join us."
With that, he turns back to his work, and I am dismissed. I start my dusting in the library, so I can pen a note to Isla, imploring her to allow me a half day off to pursue a lead. I also request a half hour of her time, so I can get advice on how to proceed. I know what I want to do. I'm less certain how to do it in this era. I include the note with her breakfast tray, which she prefers to be left outside her door after a knock. I don't make it down the stairs before I hear, "Katrina?" I hurry back to find her in the hall. She waves me into her room. Isla's room is the size of Gray's. Both are large enough, but neither is the sprawling bedchamber I expect from the size of this house. All the townhouse rooms are very much divided by purpose. You cook in the kitchen, eat in the dining room, sit and meet guests in the drawing room, study and read in the library, sleep in the bedroom. Both Gray and Isla have carved out a corner for more in their bedchambers. He has a desk for working, and she has a chaise longue for reading. Gray's desk seems shoehorned in, the space not quite big enough to hold it, as if he stubbornly insists on adding this extra purpose to what should be a mere bedchamber. Isla's chaise longue fits much better. One thing they have in common? Their bedrooms both look as if a small tornado touched down. I start to pick up a discarded dressing gown, but she shoos me away from it and into a chair. Then she proceeds to undress. I struggle not to laugh at that. Victorians have a reputation for prudery, and in some things it's well earned. But they have no problem with showing off far more cleavage than I would in the modern day, and they apparently have no problem disrobing in front of a member of their own sex. With the complicated clothing and lack of zippers, this is still a time when people of Gray and Isla's stature could expect a valet or lady's maid to help them bathe and dress. Isla doesn't seem to want that, but she strips down and reclothes herself as one accustomed to doing so in front of other women. I notice her undergarments differ from mine. Instead of the layers of petticoats that Katrina wears, Isla has a lightweight cage-like contraption to achieve that same belled skirt. Probably lighter, but I think I'll stick with the warmer petticoats myself. I also notice something else. Her discarded drawers might also be crotchless, but they button between the legs. I stare in wonder at this marvel, and decide that pockets are all well and fine, but I have a new Victorian fashion goal. Crotch buttons. She glances over her shoulder. I don't suppose you know how to tighten a corset? I presume, dare I say hope, they're gone by your time? I get to my feet. Yep, except for fun. Fun? Costume play and, intimate play. Why would anyone want... She shakes her head. Do not answer that. Hey, they're sexy, I say, and not actually as uncomfortable as I expected. From some of the books I read, they sounded like torture devices. That's because you aren't lacing yours nearly as tight as Katrina did. I used to wonder how she moved in it. Though I suspect it was less about decreasing her waist than increasing her boob shelf, I say. And that makes Isla laugh. Yes, she says, though I never got the impression she used that to woo the lads. Nah, I say. For Katrina, it would have been pure distraction. You can get away with a lot when the guys are staring at your chest. I never realized how much until I suddenly had this. I motion at my cleavage. It is both a gift and a curse. I will endeavor to use my new power wisely. I tighten her corset snugly. Good? Good enough for me, as I am not in the market for a mate, nor do I have the need or the assets for distraction. She picks up her corset cover and tugs it over her head. Now, explain this lead you are pursuing. She sounds so much like her brother that I have to smile. I stop smiling as I remember his reaction to my lead. Katrina, she says when I don't reply. Then she pauses. Or ought I to call you Mallory? In private, at least. I remember hearing a quote about no sound being sweeter than that of our own name. And damn, it feels weirdly good to hear it. But for safety's sake, we should probably stick to Katrina.
I am quite capable of not slipping up. Mallory it is, then.
This lead. You hesitate to share it. Why?
Because your brother dismissed the idea.
My brother does not realize you are a criminal officer.
True, but she doesn't know the whole story either.
I consider telling her that I brought the killer with me. But if I tell her, is she obligated to tell her brother? Would I damage their relationship by sharing investigation details she can't pass on? Is that a good enough reason to keep it from her?
I'm not sure yet. I only know that I'd rather wait until not sharing it endangers the investigation.
Of course, there's another solution to this problem, one I like a whole lot more than keeping secrets from Isla.
Maybe we should tell Dr. Gray about me, I say. Then he'd take my theories more seriously.
We cannot, she says. Not yet. Please. I need to figure out a way to convince him of the veracity of your story. I came to understand that absolute proof is impossible. He will struggle with that. Moreover, it will be a distraction he can ill afford. He has this case, which is incredibly important for Hugh, along with a paper that is incredibly important for Duncan himself.
She looks over at me.
If it were only a matter of convincing him you are not Katrina, I would attempt it for the sake of the investigation. It is not. It is convincing him of the possibility of passing through time itself, which opens endless potentialities that his mind will not be able to ignore.
When I don't answer, she says, "When we were growing up, our mother always called Duncan's brain a boisterous puppy. Give it a toy, and it will attack with vigor. Wave a brighter, shinier toy in front of him, and it will abandon the first to pursue the second. It is something he has struggled with all his life. He must force himself to focus on one at a time and not be lured away by the promise of another. He has an incredible mind, but it requires incredible discipline."
I understand what she's saying. In the modern world, it might be labeled a mild form of ADHD. But I'm not sure it's right to manage it for him. Not at his age. Gray might struggle to avoid distractions, but from what I've seen, once he's found his focus, he holds tight. Otherwise, he'd be with me today pursuing this case, instead of locked away with his paper.
Isla's concern smacks of older sibling syndrome, never quite trusting her younger brother can do things on his own, wanting to fix problems for him. Yet I'm a newcomer, and to even suggest she's babying him is to suggest I know the man better. I don't. I just think I might, as an outsider, see him more clearly, my view unmarred by the gauzy layers of his younger selves.
"Please, Mallory," she says, "trust that I know my brother's mind. We will tell him. Once his paper is done, or when there is a lull in the investigation. Until then, I will handle any doubt regarding your abilities. Now, the lead?"
I think the first victim, Archie Evans, knew the killer. I give my reasoning, insofar as I can, without bringing in the part where his torturer was a guy from the future. Without that, it's a weak argument, and Gray was right to set it aside. If she does the same, I will tell her. But she only says,
"So what do you propose to do about it?"
"Investigate Evans. I've been to his lodgings. I won't be able to speak to his roommates again. I burned that bridge."
"Dare I ask?" she says, as she buttons her blouse.
"The ringleader made me throw him into a table."
"Made you?"
"It was unfortunate. However, I did score points with the landlady, who seems sick of the little assholes. That will be my way into the house,
maybe into Evans's room. I just need a few hours off and, directions. Possibly also a bit of advice so I don't say something rude or weird and get kicked out on my arse.
In other words, I ought to go with you.
No, I just need a companion. One who understands this world and can guide you through it. One who also has not burned a bridge with the young man's friends, in case more information is needed from them.
I really don't think...
I do.
She looks at me and smiles. You do require a half day off, do you not, Miss Katrina? A half day that only the lady of the house can grant?
You're blackmailing me into taking you along?
I am indeed. Now, gather what you need, and I shall inform Mrs. Wallace that I require your assistance with my shopping today.
Chapter 32. So I'm off playing Victorian detective with Isla. If pressed, I'd admit I'm happy to have her along. Yes, it's helpful having someone who knows the city and the customs, and, better yet, that I might screw up and need rescue. But also, I like her. And while I'm in this world, she's someone I'd like to get to know better. She's also the only person in this world I can be myself with. So, yep, happy to have her along, even if I worry it's not entirely safe, which is why I'd have gone alone if I'd had the chance. We walk to the old town. If we need a cab, we'll take one home, but it's a gorgeous day, with rare sunshine. Walking also gives us the chance to first pop into a little shop on Princes Street that caters to the ladies of the new town. It's the Victorian equivalent of the Body Shop, or Sephora, with everything from creams to cosmetics. The cosmetics aren't mascara and lipstick, though. From what I've seen, there's little of that. Instead, they have tiny vials marketed as beauty aids, like mercury for your eyelashes. Or you can lighten your freckles and sunspots with lead sulfate. Isla points those out and assures me that she also avoids them, the advantage to being a chemist. I pick up a jar of hand cream that smells of tea roses and vows to keep my hands silky smooth. Somehow I suspect that promise doesn't extend to the cracked hands of a housemaid, but if I'm going to blow some of the cash in my pocket, hand lotion is at the top of my most wanted list. As I turn the jar over, looking for an ingredient list, the shop clerk fixes me with the kind of narrow-eyed look I haven't gotten since preteen Mallory would wander into MAC Cosmetics with her friends. Even after I set down the jar, she keeps glaring. Isla comes over, and I whisper, "Did I miss the no maids allowed sign?"
"No, but it is also possible this isn't the first time you've been in here."
"Ah, right. Light-fingered cat strikes again.
Also, yes, this would not be a shop frequented by servants."
She lowers her lips to my ear.
"And you do not want that cream. It is overpriced and almost certainly adulterated goods. Let me concoct something for you at home."
"Can I concoct it myself?"
"With supervision." "You most certainly may," she says with a smile. "I am as delighted to share my work as my brother is, though I suspect you shall find mine far less interesting. If you like the smell of that cream, though, then our work here is finished. We have a gift for the landlady."
She takes the jar to the clerk, who wraps it in the most exquisite packaging. Isla murmurs something, and the woman smiles and stamps the packaging with the store's intricate logo. Then we are off. On the way, I ask Isla about Katrina. That's a dead end. She knows nothing about the girl, except that she seems to have come from a middle-class family. Katrina would say no more about it. Not to Isla, and not to MacReady. I'll need to hope Davina has more. We arrive at the rooming house, and slip around to the back entrance, which Isla believes will lead to the landlady's kitchen and personal quarters. Before we knock, Isla rummages in her small handbag for a tin and holds it out. Peppermint? I peer in at the tiny lozenges. They're the size of Tic Tacs, but look more like painkillers. Yes, they are only peppermints, she says.